The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes, by Nancy R. Piercy, Baker, 2023, 344 pages. A brief book summary from Books at a Glance. About the author. Nancy Piercy is a Christian intellectual who has lectured widely and has published several influential books in the areas of Christian worldview and social issues. Table of Contents. Introduction. Why I wrote this book. 1. Why can't we hate men? 2. Progressive patriarchs. 3. The paradox of Christian marriage. 4. Pioneers and Puritans. 5. Manhood in the machine age. 6. Are women superior? 7. Taming men. 8. The wild child. 9. Your inner barbarian. 10. Have we religion for men? 11. Beating up on fathers. 12. Bringing fathers back. 13. The power of men. 14. A cure for marital cancer. Epilogue. Summary. Chapter 1. Why can't we hate men? The term toxic masculinity has become an umbrella term to connote sexism, misogyny, violence, and aggression. Many hear the message that there is something intrinsically negative about masculinity. In reality, masculinity was created by God, and it is the disordering effects of sin that are the problem, not masculinity itself. In cultures around the world, there is dichotomy between how the terms a good man and a real man are defined. People can identify positive masculine traits, but to be told to be a real man often brings up negative stereotypes. Rather than accuse men of being toxic, we need to help them to grow in the virtues that characterize good men who love, care, provide, protect, and sacrifice. As our society has become more secular, the secularized real man has become more negative. What we need is a return to the biblical definition of a good man. Honor, faithfulness, bravery, and self-control are traits that characterize biblical masculinity. But today in society, and tragically the church, too often men are living in shameful and sinful ways. Far too many women are assaulted and exploited. Nevertheless, even some feminists are realizing that the pendulum has swung too far, and now men and boys are being deflated in ways that are unfair and harmful. Today, girls and women outperform males in academics from kindergarten to the highest levels. Society is not giving young men the tools they need to flourish, and then they are blamed for their negative traits. Although elite men are extraordinarily successful, the average man is doing worse than before. How can we discern which traits are created by God and which are products of sin? One helpful framework is to examine these things in terms of creation, fall, and redemption. In creation, God proclaims that both men and women equally bear His image. Before the fall, human beings were given the cultural mandate to fulfill, and husbands and wives were called to make their marriage their new primary relationship. That is, it superseded clan and extended family. The fall into sin introduced disorder in relationship, and now husbands often try to dominate rather than care for their wives. There's a wider level of trait variation within each sex than between the sexes, but there are also some important physical and psychological differences. Chapter 2. Progressive Patriarchs. A major study has found that 90% of people believe there is a crisis in fatherhood today, and the majority of these respondents believe that the church and communities of faith are the best places to learn about fatherhood. Despite negative stereotypes, conservative Christian men who regularly attend church score higher in relationships with their wives and children, and have the lowest rates of divorce and domestic abuse in America. Nominal Christians, however, do conform to the negative stereotypes and are actually more likely than secular men to be abusive. Any stats that do not take these two very different groups into account will be skewed. We must look at evangelicals as a distinctly religious rather than a sociological category. Studies show that there is little difference in a wife's happiness in complementarian or egalitarian marriages. The main predictor for happiness is how family-centered her husband is, and family-centeredness is taught in church. The more emotional work the husband does, the happier a marriage is. And theologically conservative men do most of this kind of work. The happiest wives in America are in conservative evangelical marriages, and they also experience the greatest sexual satisfaction. Conservative religious fathers are more involved with their children in positive ways than their secular counterparts. Regular church attendance is of the utmost importance for healthy families and for the rejection of toxic masculinity. Studies around the world have shown that when men convert to conservative evangelical beliefs, they treat their wives and their children better. They engage less in harmful behaviors and display more positive traits and actions. The Bible teaches that men should be emotionally healthy, expressing a full range of emotions. Chapter 3. The Paradox of Christian Marriage. In many Christian marriages, both partners believe that they are equal, but the husband is the head with certain leadership responsibilities. He is like a first among equals. The Christian view of marriage was completely revolutionary in the Greco-Roman world. Never before had women been given such dignity and mutual rights. Married men were allowed to engage in all kinds of extramarital sex. But Christianity limited sexual expression exclusively to husband and wife. Husbands are never told in Scripture to rule over their wives, but rather to love them as their own body and to sacrifice for them. Headship is not about power and privilege, but responsibility. A husband is to lead in love and service, forgiving and repenting. He is to lead by setting the example of being worthy of emulation. Most people view headship in terms of spiritual leadership rather than in terms of authority or breadwinning. Good leaders empower and encourage others to fulfill their callings and use their gifts. In complementarian marriages, decisions are almost always made with discussion and mutual agreement. If a man needs to assert that he's the boss, the marriage is in trouble. Christ submitted to the will of the Father, and equals can choose to be submissive in their relationships. Being submissive means sharing your strengths and ideas, helping someone else lead and make decisions. Before a man can lead his wife, he needs to follow and submit to Christ. The Bible elevated the role of women as wives and mothers in a way unprecedented in the ancient world. It is Christ Jesus himself, his love, service, and sacrificial death, who is the model for husbands loving their wives. Chapter 4. Pioneers and Puritans. How did our society move from a view of rugged masculinity as positive to the current view that it is mainly negative or even toxic? Why has the perception of men and their actual behavior shifted negatively? Prior to the Industrial Revolution, work was a family industry, and men supported their families and spent their time working and living with them in an integrated way. In fact, it is not misleading to speak of men in the colonial era as house fathers, engaged in many activities that today we associate with mothering. Women also did hard work around the home and in farming, and the family was the center of social life. A good home ran like a miniature society, with great interdependence. Fathers were priests in their families, teaching and leading people in prayer. The most common characteristic was not authoritarianism, but tender love. Members of the family were not to seek their own interests, but the common good, and men were to lead the way in this selflessness. Manhood was defined in terms of duty and service. Strength and vigor were to be channeled into communal advancement rather than selfish ambition. The Puritans are often depicted as cold and authoritarian, but their sermons emphasized the sweet love that can exist between husband and wife. They passed the first laws making spousal abuse illegal and argued that there was equality between men and women. In the Genesis account, Eve is created as Adam's Iser Kenedgo, which means she is his help or ally, his perfect counterpart. Peter described wives as the weaker partner, not referring to intelligence and character, but to the social, economic, and physical realities of the first century. We need to recognize that pregnancy and childcare made women very vulnerable. And even today, physical strength is rooted in biology. It is not a social construct. God sometimes uses maternal imagery to describe his love for his people. So there are things we learn about God that we can only learn from women. Chapter 5. Manhood in the Machine Age. In the Industrial Revolution, the family home and work environment were broken up as fathers had to go to work in factories and businesses. Removed from family for hours per day, men worked not for the cultural mandate, but for acquisition and advancement in competition with others. Secular ideas began to weaken religious convictions. Work had once united husbands, wives, and children, but now that bond was broken. Many people began to note the change for the worse in men's attitudes. The values, attitudes, and skills of the marketplace did not translate to home and family relationships, and the latter suffered. The reformers had insisted that all work was a sacred vocation, and economic principles had to be directed by biblical virtues. In America, this connection of virtue and economics was severed. A split began to develop between facts and values. The former was public and objective, while the latter was private and subjective. Science was public and universal, but religion was to be kept private. Industry was free to operate in facts, leaving morality and values to the side. Many men tried to maintain a split between religion at home and value-free work in public, but this divide wasn't tenable. Society had been founded on a covenant, but now it was seen as a social contract. In the former, everyone looked out for the common good. But in the latter, everyone focuses on their own self-interest, and there is no real common good. During this time of revolution, the idea of what it meant to be manly shifted from virtue, care, and courage to the attributes needed to get ahead in a ruthless economy. Nevertheless, sermons still inculcated many of the older values and approaches to family life, and Christian fathers often attempted to continue with the best of their tradition. They were countercultural and resisted the secularizing erosion of virtuous masculinity. Chapter 6. Are women superior? Some people were desperate for the values being erased from the public square, so they idealized the home. Since it was women who now managed this space, feminine virtue was prized. Women were associated with the private sphere and values, while men were tied to the public sphere and facts. For the first time in the 19th century, we began to see some equations that women are good and men are bad, with the accompanying critical judgments. Men were free to live out a secular worldview in public, while expecting their wives to order the home and teach Christian virtues in private. This let men off the hook of responsibility and morality. The home was feminine, and it was the bulwark against the harmful masculine world outside. Men were breadwinners and competitive, but women were loving and nurturing. Historically, men were seen as more rational and virtuous than women, even in the sexual domain. In the new order, however, virtue was tied to emotion, and women were seen as more emotional. Women became moral guardians and consciences. Women were empowered, but men were released from moral responsibility and leadership. Men were seen as prone to vice, and women were expected to restrain them. This led to tension between the sexes. Even the church began to center its messages more and more on women, feminizing virtues and making women models for men. Increasingly, fathers stopped leading religious exercises in the home. We need to recapture the biblical view of God and the reality that Jesus Christ is the man who reveals true masculinity. Chapter 7. Taming Men. Social ills and vices were associated with men, and women led the way to social reformation. As they did, it was the men themselves, rather than just their sins, that began to be attacked. With the split between the private and public sphere, combined with the view that let men off the hook of moral responsibility, men's behaviors did grow worse during this time. Hard drinking reached unprecedented levels, and sexual conquest and brothels proliferated. This time saw an extreme revolution in how men viewed sex. The temperance movement attempted to get men out of the taverns and back to their homes, and anti-vice activism did the same. Men were the ones who drank, and men exploited and financed prostitution. They also broke up families in the slave trade. The fact that women were combating these ills showed that men had failed. Novels of the time were most often authored by women, and the plots showed the love of women taming the vices of men. Much of the rhetoric casts men as brutish and coarse, with women refined and virtuous. Rather than castigating men, or assuming that women are less depraved or morally superior, we need to recapture a biblical view of both male and female, the value of the home, and the necessity of work tied to the cultural mandate. Jesus is to be our model for morality. In his day, women and children were devalued, but he honored them and blessed them. Chapter 8. The Wild Child. When men left home to work, they created the first generation of boys who were raised by women. This created a boy culture, where boys were rowdy and pushed against rules. Since rules were associated with the feminine, boys could easily see that the male culture was different. Boys suffered an identity crisis as they were disconnected from their father's example and working together. Boys either rebelled against their mother's attempt to feminize them, or they were considered sissies. Literature moved from moralizing about angelic boys to seeing boys as wild, mischievous pranksters. When they grew up, this boy culture was carried forward into adulthood, with men resisting confinement in being overly civilized. A dichotomy emerged with men as aggressive and women as genteel. At home, men began to disengage from family for their own leisure and to have a break from the stress of the world. It was at this time that the den was created. Henpecked husbands became a theme, and a revolt started against moralizing wives and women. Previously, marriage and the home were seen as desirable for men, but now, Lone Ranger adventures and freedom from home were idealized. Christianity was replaced by a rootless cowboy narrative and ethic. The myth of the noble savage was a backlash against the moralizing, extreme civilizing that was taking place. The Scouts was started with the explicit goal of freeing boys from the apron strings of their mothers and making men out of them in the wild. Freedom for men is not found in high adventure in the Wild West, but in a relationship with God the Father and living in relationships as He has ordained. Marriage and being fruitful is an original part of the cultural mandate, and there is no greater adventure than serving God in fulfilling these creative tasks and shaping culture across the earth. Chapter 9. Your Inner Barbarian. Tired of being lambasted, men turned criticisms of their vices into badges of honor and embraced their barbarian, crude, competitive, and lacking virtuous self-control. Darwinianism taught that human beings were animals, and many believed that society was a veneer that needed to be removed so that men could recapture their fundamental animal nature. Social Darwinism and the survival of the fittest through struggle cast war as a positive good. Literature began to depict masculinity in terms of eschewing civilizing influences and going back into the wild. Christianity called men to live up to the divine, but Darwinism pulled people downward. Darwinian theory was seen as prizing conquest, struggle, strength, and dominance, with only aggressive men surviving. God was eliminated, and piety, virtue, and morality were limited to the home, that is, the domain of women. Rather than honor the blueprint of the Creator, sinful disorder was enshrined as natural for men. Men were created to be husbands and fathers, but promiscuity is considered natural in Darwinism. Tell men that they are wild animals, irresponsible, prone to bad behavior, etc., and they will live down to those expectations. The biblical view is entirely different, and men need to live out their masculinity in its light. To be a man and to act like a man is to follow God's laws. The contrast is not between acting like a man instead of a woman, but rather acting like a strong adult man rather than a child. Chapter 10. Have we a religion for men? In response to the trends in culture, some churches grew concerned to bring men back to church and to establish Christianity as masculine rather than purely for women. It was at this time that the muscular Christianity movement began. Christianity was seen to promote athletics and strength, as well as to propel men to take the business world for Christ. As we have seen, it is true that God has given us the cultural mandate, and men are to act for Christ in every domain. The early fundamentalists contrasted Christianity that makes men into men with theological liberalism that makes men effeminate. They argued that real men were Christians. Rather than recovering the biblical emphasis on equality in sin, salvation, and righteousness, many fundamentalists swung too far and blamed women more than men for debauchery in society. They held that men were more likely to be stronger Christians and that women were inferior in various ways. Men were told to lead, and often husbands were instructed to rule over their wives and correct them. Chapter 11. Beating up on fathers. In the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution, men were often out of touch relationally and in the home. As a result, they began to be seen as incompetent in that sphere. Despite ideological claims, the best predictor of antisocial behavior is if a boy grows up without an involved father. How can masculinity be toxic when being raised fatherless is the best predictor of problems? Fatherhood was devalued in culture, with men being absent from the home earning wages, and then simply reinforcing the mother's instructions and telling children to mind their mama. A new shift occurred where fathers were seen as playmates for the children. They organized holidays and events, but had less character-forming authority. Today, media and children's books reinforce the idea that fathers are buffoons who can be dismissed by their children. Women are seen to create wise rules, which fathers try to childishly evade. Teens are constantly pressured by peer culture on social media, and even with loving parents, the damage that can be done in these immature and unstable communities is enormous. As much as children need fathers, scientific research reveals that positive father-child bonding is extremely healthy for men. It creates a positive range of emotional awareness and provides mental health benefits. Biochemistry in the brain changes as new fathers bond with their children. When men are involved in the home, wives and children report higher rates of happiness, and men report higher satisfaction. Fatherhood is not a social construct. It is created, designed, and built into man's DNA by God. Boys need involved fathers to teach them how to be men, and boys need fathers to teach them how to be men of God. Fatherless boys can still be incredibly impacted for good by men who act as father substitutes. Chapter 12. Bringing Fathers Back. Studies find that men, as much as women, report conflict between work and home, and that 95% of men say they wish they had more time to spend with their families. Fathers who are invested at home are often more productive workers and are more effective at getting along with others. The older ideal of a male employee sacrificing everything for career is unhealthy for everyone. Technology can provide new flexibility for working from home and working around family commitments. Some fathers have tried telecommuting, and others have even switched jobs or reduced their time on the career fast track. Study after study shows that working beyond 40 hours per week actually decreases productivity. It may be possible to return to a family economic enterprise. Churches and Christian ministries need to lead the way in refusing to require overwork and in supporting their employees' family priorities. When we talk about the traditional family, we should go much farther back than the 1950s. Chapter 13. The Power of Men. Committed Protestant men have the lowest rate of abuse in the nation, but nominal Protestant men have the highest. Research has found that husbands are more influential in the health of a marriage than wives. Tragically, boys and men are socialized in ways that are inimical to the relational health in the home. There are numerous good men who are behaving badly, well-intentioned, but unaware of how to build emotional relationships. Men can frighten and intimidate their wives and children even when they don't intend to. Verbal assaults can be extremely damaging, and words can be used to bully and control. Husbands who are physically abusive are often very much in control and know exactly what they are doing. Abusers believe that men are superior and need to enforce their dominance. Anger and control can be addictive, and they make people feel superior, which leads to disregarding the feeling of others. Treating one's wife poorly leads to a disruptive relationship with God, and every vice needs to be replaced with a godly virtue. It takes great strength to be emotionally open. Abusers are most likely to have been abused or rejected themselves by their fathers when they were growing up. We all need to know the healing love of God the Father. Chapter 14. A Cure for Marital Cancer. Churches need to take domestic abuse seriously and ensure that they are not siding against the victim. Pastors need to speak about these issues from the pulpit even before any cases of abuse are known of in the congregation. There are some men who twist headship and submission to mean that they can treat their wives any way they want, and that abuse is the woman's fault for failing to submit or support the way that she should. Abuse is not first a problem in the relationship. It is a problem in the abuser's heart. One commonality is that perpetrators see themselves as victims and justified in their actions. Although women can be abusive towards men, the reality is that women are 9 times more likely to be hurt in an abusive situation. Techniques that will work to improve a marriage that is somewhat healthy will not work with a chronic abuser. Augustine counseled wives that if their husbands were engaged in immoral practices or evil, they were not to submit to them, but submit to Christ. Abusive, sinning husbands are to be confronted rather than appeased, although in some cases wives should flee for physical safety. God Himself loves us unconditionally, yet is clear that sins hinder our relationship with Him and sometimes cause Him to draw away from us. The church needs to make support services available, and men need to hold men accountable. Without minimizing pain and the effects of trauma, God is able to bring good out of evil. He is able to heal and help us help others. God also redeems and transforms lives, so we should not give up on men who have sinned. Biblical submission does not require refraining from naming sin. In fact, we need to call sin and folly what they are. Some people may never change, and it is impossible for us to change them. Rather than working fruitlessly, we can focus on our part of the cultural mandate. Copyright 2023, Books at a Glance. Books at a Glance book summaries are available by subscription only, and except for brief quotes, may not be reproduced in whole or in part without express written permission.